Welcome to Business Trip, a podcast exploring the future of mental health and wellness. I'm Greg Kubin, and my co-host is Matthias Serebrinski. Matthias and I are partners at PsyMed Ventures, a fund investing in psychedelic medicine and frontier mental health. We launched Business Trip in 2020 as a podcast focused on psychedelics. As Matthias and I started to dive deeper into the complexities of mental health, we met more and more entrepreneurs and scientists who are creating novel treatments across many areas of mental health, not just psychedelics. Ultimately, we believe that the future of mental health will include a variety of interventions, ranging from psychedelics to neurotechnology and many other tech and biotech innovations. So going forward, we'll be covering new topics in Business Trip alongside our usual episodes about psychedelics. This episode is the first of a two-part series on the influence of the gut microbiome on mental health and wellness. The gut microbiome is the community of bacteria and other microbes that live in our body, with trillions living in our gut. Among the many important roles these bacteria play include producing neurotransmitters like serotonin and dopamine. Increasing evidence demonstrates that imbalances of bacteria in our gut affects neurotransmitter activity and influences bodily functions, ranging from mood to pain. And now there's a new crop of entrepreneurs looking to develop therapeutics that target the gut microbiome to treat these conditions. Dr. Phil Stranwitz is the founder and CEO of Holobiome, a company that develops therapies for the human microbiome. Phil is an expert in the gut-brain connection and ways to cultivate a healthy gut microbiome. And one of Holobiome's lead programs is focused on depression. In this episode, we dive deep into the science of the gut microbiome, its interactions with the brain, and its role in health and disease. We discuss microbial therapeutics and its potential to treat conditions ranging from epilepsy and constipation to pain and mental illness. We talk business and how to build a viable business model in this space. And lastly, we explore the various ways to modulate the gut microbiome, including food, prebiotics, probiotics, and even fecal, aka poop transplants. That's right. When talking about the gut and microbiome, we're of course talking about poop. Frontier medicine is sometimes like that, at once taboo. So hold on to your toilet seat. And now to the episode with Phil Stranwitz of Holobiome. Phil, welcome to Business Trip. And I'll set the stage here, which is that in our experience over the last couple of years getting smarter about the many ways that mental health can be diagnosed and treated, we're constantly finding new frontiers that are really promising and also complex and nuanced. And one of those areas that we've gotten really excited about has been the microbiome. And particularly the way in which our understanding of the microbiome is evolving and the opportunity to better understand and design microbial therapeutics, which is what has led us to meeting you and talking through both the company you're building and just the broader science of the microbiome. And so why don't we start with the gut microbiome? What is the gut microbiome?
Yeah, of course. And Greg and Matthias, thank you very much for having me on this podcast. I think it's going to be a very fun interview. So when you hear this word, the microbiome, what you're really referring to are the different microbes that live on and in humans. And in particular, this is bacteria, it's viruses, archaea, fungi. So a variety of different microorganisms that you really can't see. What's astonishing with these microbes, which has been revealed in the past 15 years, is that we have a tremendous number of them. Each of you has more microbes than there are stars in the Milky Way. And there's roughly one microbial cell for each human cell that you walk around with every day. And so this is an astonishing community that makes you, you. It also very clearly highlights that humans are never in isolation. We've always been with our microbes. And these bacteria and other organisms have co-evolved with us. You get them from your parents when you're born. You get them from people you interact with. You get them from your pets. You get them from the food you eat. So you're constantly exposed to these organisms. And what's astonishing as you think about this field, which everywhere you look today, it's all over the headlines, whether it's in Nature articles or science or popular press, is you really didn't know much about it until about 15 years ago. Really, what broke the game was the development of sequencing. So sequencing technology is where you can swab anything you want and actually get an idea of what DNA resides within that system, or RNA, about 15 years ago. Sequencing technology was getting to a point, really built upon the Human Genome Project, where scientists could start to swab stuff and ask what in the world exists in this ecosystem. And so around that time, when we started to apply sequencing technology to swabbing humans, we were astonished with the diversity. It just blew the minds of a lot of folks that have been looking at human microbiology for some time. So we had this entire ecosystem that we didn't even know existed. Since then, we've started to uncover potential understandings of how these microbes could actually be driving things like disease, influencing resilience to disease, influencing how we age, and various aspects of our day-to-day. But it's this incredible science that I found myself at, very luckily, in grad school.
My understanding is that about 80% of our bacteria resides in the gut. And the way in which the bacteria then communicates to our brain is through the gut-brain axis. And that's a critical component of this whole story.
Yep, absolutely. Let me just zoom out a little bit, because I painted that picture of we're covered in microbes, a reflection of our lives, of who we are, and where we came from. We've started to identify as a field not only who's there, but how they're connected to different aspects of our biology. So one early place where folks were very focused on, and historically with microbiology, was infectious disease, right? But the intricacies of how this complex ecology interfaces with things like our immune system and our nervous system, our endocrine system, this is quite novel. And what's fascinating is there's actually been a lot of signals, if you look back in history and somewhat objectively, that microbes are involved in modulating things like the brain. And one good example there would be depression. The hypothesis is that all these microbes, 100 trillion of them that live within your GI tract, could be influencing behavior. Could we maybe see co-occurrence between GI symptoms and depression? And the answer is largely yes. Some around 75% of people with depression report GI disturbances. We've known for a while that microbiome modulators can come with an increased or decreased risk of depression. So diet's one of those. There's also drugs that target the microbiome. And now, with the advancement of sequencing, you can take a very objective approach to just hone in on mechanisms microbes can be influencing that could be involved with depression, potentially causal in depression in certain people.
What happens in the gut microbiome, what happens in the gut is actually what could be causing disease?
Yeah, there's evidence pointing in that direction, for sure. And ultimately, we want to prove this in very nicely controlled clinical studies, of course. But here's a couple more things that walk in the direction of causality. So we could go down the same path with things like neurodegenerative disorders, potentially aspects of autism, a healthy aging, dementia. So there's many of these different areas. It takes the same almost Mad Lib-like approach of, can we see a connection? But so beyond looking at GI symptoms, beyond looking at diet associations or drug level associations, there's also just crazy experiments you can do. And it's been shown multiple times where you can take the microbiome from people with depression. So take their poop, basically, and put that into animals. And you can transmit depressive-like behavior. But if you take the microbiome from people who are healthy, not depressed, you don't transfer any behaviors. So this screams that maybe there's something in those microbes from that depressed individual that could be driving some of these effects. And that's what gets you to the next natural line of, say, therapeutic development or understanding how our crazy system works. Maybe it's GABAergic activity, serotonin signaling, different monoamines, neuroinflammation, whatever. Make your list. And then ask the simple question, can microbes influence those targets? Using the same models that people are using to do traditional drug discovery. And the answer is largely yes. even these targets that folks are looking at for depression, if you hit one right and safely, this is also a great boon to our armamentarium for combating mental health. So that's what I mean in terms of trying to uncover this biology. The hard part is it's really hard. So when you start to combine all the complexities of microbiology with neuroscience and with drug discovery, but I think the outcome of that is so promising, so promising. And I think all of us know folks that are suffering with mental health disorders, and we just want more tools to try and beat this.
So with this idea of more tools, one of the things that we discuss a lot in the podcast is that some of the labels for mental health disorders, depression, anxiety, are many times a description of symptoms, but they don't say a lot about the biology of the disease, what's underlying those symptoms. So I'm curious, from a gut microbiome perspective, if modulating this bacteria would help everyone, would help a subtype of, let's say, depressed patients. How you think of who's this good for and who's not good for?
It's a really good question. And, you know, it's not microbiome that's the only field, obviously, that's addressing this, as you brought up. But we're hopeful that if we can have bacteria or other interventions that can actually target biological aspects of us that we think are important for a disease, it can work for a lot of people. Practically, there's going to be many subtypes of depression, and we know that already. You have treatment-resistant depression. In some cases, the serotonin-acting drugs work. In other cases, they don't. Obviously, as we're thinking of psychedelics, there's a lot of really strong promise there, too, of folks that respond that don't otherwise. Things like postpartum depression, this could be a totally different disease. And so once you start to break it down of really, here's a disease, we can study the biological signals, the biomarkers that could be associated with it, then we can start to think of how many people could we potentially help. And if you make an imaginary list of, say, 15 target, you can take what we have already and ideally have that there, but then you can also have microbes that maybe hit other targets. And you can think about combining these. So for us, the real answer to this is running the right trials, collecting the data of the interventions. So our lead program is a single strain of bacteria that we selected to hit two targets we think are relevant for depression, one neurotransmitter mediated, the other neuroimmune mediated. And of course, we'll be monitoring if those mechanisms change in those people. And also looking at things like baseline microbiome to see if there's microbes that could be influencing outcomes of some of these responses. But what's fascinating to me as a starry-eyed scientist turned entrepreneur is we really do have the tools now to ask these types of questions. You can do longitudinal surveys of things like cytokines in blood or biomarkers that your drug's related to or microbiome differences over time. And the cost of doing that is getting lower. So it's an incredible time to stratify patients, but we're optimistic that if we pick the right microbes and they're truly involved in regulating these different pathways, there's a chance to do good really broadly. And then one last thing I want to just highlight, the right human microbe or set of human microbes can be designed to hit more than one target. Our lead program in depression hits two very independent targets that would be impossible to target with a single molecule. But because microbes are really just little bags of proteins and metabolites, you can actually screen for bacteria that hit those and have more than one.
We'll definitely go to the specific programs. I want to go deeper into this idea of hidden targets. You mentioned GABA, serotonin. So what is really the connection between these neurotransmitters and the gut bacteria? It's not that obvious at first sight.
Starting maybe at first principles, one question I'd like to just lay out there for the audience is humans, we have these neurotransmitters, we have neuromodulators. Where did we get the protein machinery to produce and sense these in the first place? And when you look at the evolutionary tree of like where those came from, where we got them from, it's pretty clear we got most of them from microbes. So you have bacteria that live in soil, you have bacteria that live in your gut that actually have the same machinery to produce things like even dopamine, GABA, some of these other neurotransmitters. When you think about our systems for neurotransmission too, like how our cells produce, say, serotonin, it requires an input, which is tryptophan. Tryptophan will largely come from your diet. Microbes influence your diet. So there's a few ways that microbes can influence neurotransmission. One would be directly through production of neuroactive compounds that can be sensed by cells locally and potentially peripherally. There's also the ability of microbes to influence precursors of some of these pathways as well, even guide like how tryptophan is metabolized, if it's metabolized towards serotonin, or it's metabolized towards something like kynurenine, which is oftentimes thought to be the bad path that tryptophan can take. And we try to simplify a few of these different concepts. And like you, me, Greg, we're all just a big bag of protein-protein interactions in biochemistry with some separate compartments. Microbes are just smaller bags, and they influence the input. So as you think about like the chemistry in our blood, around 50% of that is influenced by our gut microbiome. As we think about dietary conversion, there's things we eat that we can't digest on our own. We need our microbes. So they're really important in liberating those nutrients that then feed us. Breast milk's a super good example of here's a very clear evolutionary pressure for mothers to evolve certain sugars, very complex ones, in breast milk that the baby alone can't digest. But with the help of its microbial buddies, it can. And this is just how woven we are. And we've basically totally ignored this. And the negative spin on it is, have we really caused chaos in humanity's microbiome with antibiotics and poor diet and a variety of artificial compounds, the reduction of fermented food? And if we have created that chaos, and that's tied with the increase of certain diseases like depression and others, how do we fix it? How can we actually give people tools to change their microbiome with meaning?
So to recap, is that these bacteria are, you know, on one side factories of neurotransmitters and also of precursors of neurotransmitters. And at the same time, they condition how certain proteins are metabolized. With that in mind, there's been this pseudo theory around depression caused by a chemical imbalance of serotonin. And now there's multiple studies that kind of show that it's not the way that it works. And also, a lot of the new kind of treatments and modalities are more focused on like circuit level interventions. How you make sense of the ability of the gut microbiome to affect neurotransmitters with the idea that might not be the way that biology works when it comes to mental health disorders?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And so when it comes to serotonin signaling and depression driven by the microbiome, at least to date, I don't think there's much evidence at all that GI tract-derived serotonin is helpful for depression. There is actually recently some evidence that serotonin in the gut may even be tied to things like anxiety, and that was published a few weeks ago. And so the simplistic model of one molecule yields a phenotype. It's all situational of like where the molecule is and where expression from sensing it happens as well. And so as you think about the gut-brain axis, there's a few different ways that scientists have honed in on how bacteria could be influencing the brain. So one could be producing molecules that make it to sites that could have a particular impact. And in the case of the serotonin drugs that you brought up, SSRIs have other effects as well, which some folks are hypothesizing could actually be driving some of the effects that people who do take it see. But when it comes to a microbial perspective, when you have these factories in your gut that could produce molecules, they can make it into the blood and make it into the brain and have direct effects in certain areas there. And there's certain classes of molecules where there's good evidence that happens. Another path is where in the GI tract, there's actually cells that sense things and directly signal to the brain. This is where I think actually the majority of crosstalk does happen, where you have certain cellular populations, which were relatively recently identified, called enterochromaffin cells. A subset of those are called neuropod cells. So these are neurons that live within the gut. They sense ligands, including sugars and other things. They're basically hardwired to the vagus nerve with the terminal neuron in the brain. So you have a direct signaling cascade from the gut to the brain and the microbial soup, as well as food that exists in that domain, where this appears to be a mechanism to drive feeding behavior. But there's additional work showing that this could be driving behavior as well, things like stress, as well as depression. And in our animal experiments with the microbes that we were looking at developing, again, we found a single strain of bacteria, efficacy as good as ketamine in animal models of stress-induced depression. But if you sever the vagus, this goes away. And the model itself doesn't even work. So to me, that screams this is a major pathway of communication. So again, you have one, which is peripheral secretion of metabolites that make it into the brain that has to then pass through the blood-brain barrier, which is its own challenge in many different ways. You have direct sensing of molecules in the gut. And then there's several other pathways too, which look pretty important. So one could be immune mediated, where you have microbes in the gut that have certain things they produce. You have immune cells like T cells that are actually sensing in the gut area, and they translocate to the brain. And there is some beautiful work that identified this gut to T cell to brain translocation of these immune cells are actually driving things like neuroinflammation. So we as a system, we want to sense what's happening in our body. And one place to sense is the gut, because that's where the majority of, say, foreign inputs come in. So we've designed these really brilliant, somewhat redundant pathways to see what's going on and respond, either with a behavior or some other physiological response. And in the eyes of our microbes, because they're happy and healthy, you know, they probably want to keep us happy too. So it's a very interesting system all around when you zoom out.
And in this zooming out, one of the things that it's becoming very clear is that because these are living organisms, things are a lot more complicated and potentially messy. And that could be a good thing, right? Because as you mentioned, it could have different pathways, hit different targets. But it's becoming more and more clear to me that this is a very different ballgame than small molecules.
Exactly. I think the reality is we're just messy and we're born messy. We've evolved messy. And there's the hygiene hypothesis of being too clean is probably not good. I'm a believer in that camp to some extent. And that gets us back to that problem of if we're dirty beans and we're hypersanitized and we now have tools and situations that can totally destroy our microbiome, how do you fix it? And one simple way to think about this is the diversity of, say, the gut and how that's where most microbes live. Within each person, you have something around 200, 250 species, sometimes less, of human gut bacteria that exists. So all three of us probably have around that number. Think of basically each of our guts. The microbes that live within your gut are going to be things like Bacteroides, Blotia, Faecalibacterium, all these names you've never heard of, you can't find anywhere on a bottle, because nobody in the history of man has actually developed them commercially to put them as a tool for people. And that's a huge problem, I think, if we're starting to really connect the dots between the microbiome and human health. So we're just in this weird world where the science appears to be so important. We actually don't have tools to change our microbiome with meaning. The things that people can buy today, it's largely of like the Bifidobacterium and Lactobacilli genus. This is actually a very small minority of microbes that live within humans. The reason they largely exist as products is byproducts of the dairy industry and other commercial yogurt making, a few other things like that, where they're relatively easy to grow bacteria. They've been tied to food fermentation, and it makes sense to just put them in a pill and sell them, but they certainly don't represent the functional potential of what exists within the humans, because we haven't captured that evolutionary power that we've evolved with our microbes. But the tech is here, and that's something that we're very focused on.
So you touched on some of the foods that can help cultivate more microbial diversity. Can you speak to some of the other ways that we can modulate the microbiome, whether that's prebiotics, probiotics, bacteriophages, other ways that we can catalyze that diversity?
Yeah, of course. So theoretically, in the perfect world, what you have is the different microbes that exist within people. There's about 5,000 species collectively. Everybody has, again, around 200. Not everybody has the same microbes. But you could actually just go and like get a bottle and put a microbe that has a function of interest that's been validated with science into that ecosystem. You largely can't do that again today. So basically putting in novel diversity is really tough. You can, of course, and I support it totally, fermented food. So different fermented food contains different microbes. But just because a microbe is good at, say, fermenting cabbage doesn't actually mean it's going to be good at colonizing your gut and living there. But you could still have the functional potential of the microbes in, say, your sauerkraut if you just eat it every day. So there's ways to band-aid some of this to get diversity in certain functions. Whether or not the functions of, say, sauerkraut microbes are the ones that we're talking about today still is to be determined. So from a direct, let's restore the community, there's limited tools. But fermented food could be an interesting band-aid. And we generally, as a field, suggest trying to have more fermented food. Kefir, yogurt, sauerkraut, a variety of other things too. Then there's this concept of prebiotics. And so prebiotics would be really anything that you eat that supports the microbes that live within your GI tract. The tricky part is we just don't know what the food does. And so there are things like fibers that are put into products today. And generally, fiber is considered to be a good thing. Some of the fiber you buy, it's not good for everybody. So like inulin, which is very commonly added within different foods, it does seem to support, say, diversity in some people, but it also supports growth of some bacteria that are thought to be pretty bad. And so what we really need to do as a field is map out how our food and different ingredients can directly impact microbes. And once we have that as an atlas, then it's easier for us to almost give like, hey, you have this signature, do this. The final, really more serious way to do this is fecal microbiome transplant. And for those that don't know what that is, it's what it sounds like. You take a poop from a healthy person, and then you put it into somebody who's having an issue. And this has been a practice that's been around for a really long time. In China, they have something by the name of, I think it's called brown tea, where you basically take human poop, dilute it to a level where you can barely see it's brown anymore, and then you drink it. That's been around for thousands of years. There's also been quite a lot of people that have been given fecal microbiome transplant with much more modern methods to combat infectious disease, like Clostridium difficile. And it looks really good for combating this infectious disease. And there's now two approved drugs that are basically forms of FMT, both for the treatment of Clostridium difficile infection. But again, that's how desperate folks are to restore diversity in certain cases, is, you know, poop transplant.
Okay, so we've just spent some time talking about the science, and I think it would be a good time to change gears to talking more about the business. Can you talk about what has been your approach at Holobiome at developing microbial therapeutics, and in particular, what is a microbial therapeutic?
Yeah, of course. The field has such promise to just cure a disease. The tricky part is we largely don't know what our microbes are doing, how they interface with our biology, and we don't have the tools to change our microbiome. And so Holobiome is a Boston-based platform microbiome company, and we're trying to map how human gut bacteria influence human disease. How we're doing this is we have a donor network of people that actually give us their microbiome, so they poop for us for $50. We then are able to take those samples and actually isolate all the bacteria that exist within them. So this is very, very challenging to actually take human samples and isolate microbes. It's our entire background. So from these people, we source the microbiome. And today we have one of the most diverse collections of human gut microbes that exists on the planet. So we've captured the microbiome. We've built that disorganized garden. With these microbes, we're then systematically trying to understand how they influence major aspects of human disease. So what we've been able to develop is technology and methods to take this very large strain collection and basically ask questions. How do these microbes influence disease that other fields of biology think are important for human health? And people just really aren't doing this. Isolating microbes, testing them against targets, really rolling up your sleeves. I call it roll up your sleeves biology, and building data sets around how these microbes interact with these important targets. Once we have these maps of what microbes influence what target of interest, that's when we can think about developing them. And so there's two paths that we're looking at. So one is microbiome-based therapeutics. First and foremost, there would be human-derived bacteria that could be taken orally in a pill to then target the gut and have a benefit. We're also very interested in consumer applications, making novel food. And our approach to doing this for now is B2B. And what I mean by that is we're really good at early discovery. We think we have the pieces to solve the space and uncover these incredibly powerful tools to improve human health. But the thing we're not specialized in yet is later stage clinical development, as well as marketing. So our approach to this is we know we're the experts in microbiome, but there's certain aspects of actually getting the science into the hands of people that need them that we actually think we can really collaborate well to make it happen. Right now, we have three different corporate partnerships. Two of the public ones are Unilever, in which we're identifying food ingredients that target aspects of the gut-brain axis, as well as Kenvue, which is Johnson & Johnson's new consumer arm that spun out a couple weeks ago. It's about a $50 billion market cap. Both these organizations are incredibly interested in the future of microbiome in the consumer lens. We also have a third unannounced partnership, which is with a major neuroscience pharma partner. And what's really interesting for all of these partnerships, it's really the platform and the biology that we can uncover that drives interest. And then it's just a matter of where is the best place to bring this innovation to have the largest impact. And our goal as a business is to co-develop these assets where we get royalties as well as sales milestones, which can then help come back into R&D and grow the company and the infrastructure. In addition to using a B2B business model, we're also a little atypical because we've largely bootstrapped the company. We brought in a bit over $10 million capital into the organization. Around 80% of that has been non-dilutive through partnerships as well as non-dilutive grants. We've won money from the NIDDK, as well as the National Institute of Neurological Disease and Stroke, and even a NASA-associated organization called the Translational Research Institute for Space Health. I'm in a very interesting documentary on how the microbiome could be used to help astronauts get into Mars. The combination of these partnerships, as well as these grants, that we built the platform. And it's really the platform that has the value. And as we're able to really quickly test hypotheses and uncover how our microbes influence us, our future is so promising. And that's something that obviously excites me, excites my team, but our hope is we have some really good stories soon in which we've been able to solve disease.
So you've developed this platform. You mentioned you have partnerships with a few very important players. Ultimately, the assets are microbial therapeutics, they're probiotics, there's something else. So what is it exactly? And maybe you can explain what is the difference between those categories.
Yeah, of course. And so really at a high level, there's two things that we are focused on at the moment. One is either developing live bacteria as a product, or two, finding food that feeds those microbes that we can develop alone or in combination with those microbes. So in the Unilever collaboration, it's very focused on food ingredients. So these are things that you can easily add to many of their different brands to have a targeted microbiome impact. In the J&J relationship, this is around the combination of a bacteria that they've identified as important for infant health in combination with a food ingredient to help support growth of that microbe when it gets into the gut. And then the partnership with the neuroscience organization is very open. So we're doing classical drug development. The question is largely there. Do we need a live microbe to have an effect? If we do, then we develop the live microbe. If we don't, that's where we can think about other things, like a small molecule derived from the bacteria or a protein.
And in terms of the therapeutics side of your business, can you talk a little bit about the indications that you've selected and why those indications?
Yeah, of course. So I'll start with pain. So pain is a huge problem. My dad has diabetic nerve pain. It's awful. There's visceral pain, which is associated with things like IBD. There is a range of different pain disorders that are incredibly costly to society, not only financially, but also just quality of life of people. And one of the reasons we honed in on pain was because there was more and more evidence that the microbiome can influence it. So a lot of what I shared with you before when we played Mad Libs of, is there a microbiome signature in people with pain disorders? Can you change certain pain phenotypes with diet, antibiotics, et cetera? The answer is largely yes. But in this case, the field just didn't know how. So what we ended up doing with our platform was we took, to my knowledge, the largest and most diverse panel of human gut bacteria ever screened against any target and screened it against 20 different targets that when you go and talk to pain experts, they say they're the one to go after. We did this very objectively. We just asked, can microbes influence these? What was really interesting to see, which is in line with some of the objective observations, is microbes hit these targets. So you had bacteria that could, say, reduce some of the cytokines that folks are interested in developing for pain. You also had microbes that can increase them. What we're able to do, leveraging a variety of big data approaches, is we can also figure out what's the mechanism driving this. So this allows for us to just accumulate knowledge about how the microbiome is functioning. And that then allows us to select specific indications. So like as you think about pain, but there's certain targets that make sense for subtypes of pain. So like TNF-alpha, that one's well established for going after visceral pain. Interleukin 6, that makes sense for something like neuropathy. And so by being able to match biology independent of the microbiome with a problem, and then the microbiome with that biology, it allows us to hopefully deliver something that's really safe, that's actually perhaps driving some of that disruption in the first place. And there's examples of disease, which again is so fascinating, where like UTI typically comes with pain. But there's a whole subtype of people with chronic UTI that have no pain. But if you isolate the microbe, it's analgesic. So it reduces pain. And so these signatures are screaming towards us, but we don't have an efficient machine to uncover them. And that's something that we're really focused on building. And the key part for us is making sure as we map these interest areas, we also have a corporate partner that would like to play in that space too. And that's where this pharma collaboration actually is in pain.
Interesting. We mentioned before how developing live bacteria for potential mental health indications is different, how bacteria are more messy, they're targeting multiple pathways, multiple targets. At the same time, another way to understand how it's different and potentially harder is the fact that there are only two approved microbial therapeutics in the market. So why is it harder to develop these treatments? Why are we not seeing multiple microbial-derived therapeutics if we've known for a really long time that our gut microbiome affects our overall health?
Yeah, it's a great question. So again, 15 years ago, we didn't even know who the microbes were on us. And within that period, we figured out who the microbes are on us and have two approved drugs. And the typical cycle to approve a drug is 8 to 10 years. So the fact we have wins is actually pretty promising. When you look at gene therapy and getting to where we are today, there was historic failures too. When you look at like RNAi therapeutics as well, historic failures too. There's this just sort of natural timeline of how long it takes to develop a drug. And microbiome's not free of that. Where it gets a little more complicated is we still have to learn as a field. And there are certain aspects that I don't think as a field we've learned really well. So one would be mechanism, how microbes are influencing different components of us. And that's something that we're really interested in. Another is how do you pre-screen for somebody that has a high probability of things working? When you're thinking about a live bacteria, food I think is really important. Because if you give a microbe and they eat different food every day, there can be potentially different impacts that happen. So how can you control for that? And there's different ways the field has collectively started to come together to address those things. There's also some practical considerations as well of how much funding is going into microbiome from a development perspective compared to other things. There's also considerations of IP, of how do you protect innovations like naturally occurring bacteria to treat disease or develop as consumer products. There was a learning period too for manufacturing, in which early days, some of the trailblazers of microbiome like Siri and others, they had a couple of pain points of how can we take, say, microbes and actually manufacture them at scale, microbes from humans, and then put them into a pill. Today, from a manufacturing standpoint, there's really good groups that have figured this out. From a mechanism standpoint, we have the technology to do it, and that's what we're working on here. But what you do see in like later stage clinical development today, a lot of those assets, because of the timeline it takes to develop a drug, are actually oftentimes prior to the new science, which I think has a bit more precision. But that's normal for any industry that has multiple forms of basically delivering something. So I'm very optimistic. Things are promising for the microbiome. We just have to make sure to have the right technology that's underwriting it all.
Yeah, it feels like there's a playbook to be developed. And it's not the same playbook that traditional pharma companies and mostly small molecule development has been using for so long, in the same way that for gene therapies, the playbook is also different, right? And so it's interesting to think how early we are in terms of the development of the playbook. One of the things that stuck with me is that you are entering into partnerships with companies that may be more traditionally considered food companies or CPG companies. And that may be one of the ways that the field kind of advances and even de-risks some of the assumptions that it has. And maybe in the future that will lead to more traditional kind of therapeutics. But for now, this is a way to de-risk. And this may be the new playbook that companies in the field are using.
What would be great, Phil, is if you could, in one or two sentences, describe the constipation program and then spend a little time on the depression program.
Absolutely. So I've highlighted this concept of how we approach things, which we have access to the microbiome basically as an input for a test, which I don't think very few do. So we're able to turn the microbiome into an input that's non-redundant to ask questions of how does the microbiome influence a target. So in the case of constipation, we basically took the microbiome as an input. We then asked whether or not it can influence a certain neurotransmitter-based pathway in the gut that's relevant for motility. And we identified three different ways microbes can do it. And so this involves influencing how the host synthesizes this neurotransmitter. So once we figure out the bugs that are potentially good for the purpose, we can then choose microbes using a large strain collection that not only do the thing we want, but actually look promising for commercial development with our own rules of choosing these microbes. So that's how we ended up with constipation. And then from the depression perspective, it was a very similar concept. Certain targets we were interested in, we find the microbes that hit those targets. A molecule is easy to detect from a production standpoint. Some of the immunological signatures that I brought up are much harder, but we're able to go from many different microbes. Eventually, there's a 1.17 candidates in a consortia. We went down to one, and then we were able to show this efficacy within animal models. And so can we really just turn this into simple inputs in an assay to find promising things to then think about later stage commercial development?
Phil, I'm wondering if you can give more detail about the depression program. What are these bacteria modulating? What is this specific strain modulating? What is unique to this strain? And can we find any comparison outside of the gut microbiome world around what ultimately this therapeutic would do?
Yeah, for our depression program, what we have is a single strain of bacteria. This represents a major group of organisms that live within humans, within the gut. We know they're important because they've co-evolved with us for many years. They've been tied to many aspects of human health at this point, but you literally can't buy this group of microbes. It belongs to diversity that we don't have available in probiotics, we don't have available as drugs. So this is a totally novel group of organisms that humans have never had the ability to just swallow and bring back in. We've then taken that group and identified a specific strain that has the ability to target a neurotransmitter-based pathway relevant for the etiology of depression, as well as with a very unique anti-inflammatory phenotype. And that's pretty unique. We had to screen many organisms to find it. And so let me tell you a story of a comparison of an existing probiotic, which is interesting. So largely, the field of, say, probiotics and microbiology have relied on serendipity to find stuff. So as we think about probiotics, there is one by the name of E. coli Nissl 1917, which was discovered by Alfred Nissl in 1917. This was found during the war. He was working with a troop that all got dysentery, except for one person. That resulted in Dr. Nissl looking at the microbes that live within that person's gut in really rudimentary ways. So they took the human stool sample, they grew it up, they made a little culture of it, they then fed it to the other soldiers, and it largely improved their dysentery. This was a random event that identified that specific microbe because Nissl was there. That today is one of the most commonly sold probiotics in the world by the name of E. coli Nissl 1917, sold by the company Artifarm in Germany. We're instead taking an approach where we're not relying on serendipity. Instead, we're relying on what we know of biology and just finding those right bugs. And this is a strain level feature. So just because you have a microbe with a given name, that doesn't mean it's actually good for a given purpose. And you can have strong variation with microbes that have the same name, like E. coli Nissl 1917. Probiotic. E. coli causes a recall of spinach. But trying to get at, is there a real world example of special bugs and that we're trying to, and we have a platform to uncover the special bugs with a lot more focus.
All right. Yeah, let's get to the rapid fire.
What are the wildest indications that bacteria could treat in the future?
Longevity, I think, has a lot of promise from a perhaps how long you live, but also healthy aging.
What convinced you to jump into entrepreneurship versus continuing in a research lab setting?
I think it's very easy in academia to just publish a lot and then move on to the next thing. I just didn't want to spend my life making PDFs. And I was motivated to turn the science into products that can help people.
What are the risks of these therapies?
There's always risks when you change a system. But when it comes to the microbiome, there's a lot less risks than other things, because the organisms we're thinking of developing came from healthy people. They didn't come from the soil. And there's also good evidence that things like fecal transplant actually have relatively low side effects and adverse events in clinical trials. The largest risk is an intervention you develop doesn't have the effect you want, but safety, it's really good. Thus, the upside is very high if you could cure something with the right science here.
This is a long shot. If you are depressed, is it possible that the microbial community living within you is also depressed?
Interesting. It's all semantics, right? Of, you know, what is depressed? And so it could certainly be that ecosystem is stressed, and that could be pretty bad for a microbe. Maybe they don't have as much cooperation as a healthy person. If you have GI symptoms, which a lot of people with depression do, you may have a lot of inflammation, and the microbes you evolved with probably don't like that. You may also have motility issues. Many of the microbes may not like that. So I would be willing to bet a happy gut community makes a happy person.
Happy gut, happy life.
Yep. So 10 years ago, when the gut-brain axis was first being presented, it was almost laughed out of conference halls. I still remember giving a talk at Harvard about some early autism work potentially linking the microbiome to it or some of its symptoms. And there was someone in the front row that just slammed their book shut, stood up in the middle of my talk and walked out and said, this is impossible. But now you go to neuroscience conferences, it's everywhere. Microbiome is basically always there. Nature, science, I publish as a microbiologist in the journal Brain Research. So we're really seeing the shift of acceptance. And that's what I think is so special. The microbiome is the ultimate dogma challenger, because it comes back to maybe these little microbes are ruling us all.
Awesome. Phil, thank you for coming to the show. And I'm looking forward to learning about holobiome and everything that you do in the next few years.
This is Business Trip, a podcast exploring the future of mental health and wellness. If you like this episode, you can help us by subscribing to the podcast and leaving a review. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at SciMedVentures. And if you're building a company in frontier mental health, hit us up at hi@scimed.ventures, which you can find in the show notes. I'm Greg Kubin, and my co-host is Matthias Serebrinski. Caitlin Nur coordinates our podcast. Production and editorial assistance comes from Jonathan Davis. Sound design and engineering by Nico Ray. Our theme music is by Dorian Love, and additional music credits are in the show notes. This is Business Trip. Thanks for tripping with us. We'll see you next time.